Zenobia, Queen of Palmyra. Now, Zenobia was the 3rd century A.D., Queen of Palmyra. She was born to a chieftain in Syria in 229 A.D. Her father's name was Ulius or Julius Aurelius Zenobius, and her mother was believed to be Egyptian because Zenobia was very conversant in ancient Egyptian and really admired the Egyptian culture. And then when she takes over, she's also going to want to conquer Egypt and add it to her empire. Now, Zenobia was born in the city of Palmyra, which is in Syria, on the edge of the Eastern Empire. And it bordered Rome's old enemy, the old Parthian Empire, which had been taken over by the Sinassids. Now, Palmyra had been part of the Roman Empire since 114 AD. It is a major caravan trading center, and it is just full of wealth, from the trade. Now, accounts of Zenobia, which to some extent are difficult because of the time period in the Roman Empire. One of the accounts comes from a writer who wrote his material about 410, and then there are some other accounts in there. But for the most part, she was considered dark-complected, well, which is not a surprise since her father is Syrian and her mother is Egyptian. She had black eyes. She had a really kind of a melodic voice, which was kind of captivating. She's considered charmingly beautiful, which means that she wasn't really spectacularly beautiful, but she had enough charm that most people overlooked that, and extremely intelligent. She knew Greek, Aramaic, Egyptian, and Latin. She also studied history. Later on, she claimed to be the descendant of Queen Dido, who was the queen of Carthage, the woman who founded the city of Carthage, which had been Phoenician. She studied all the Greek philosophers and writers. She was a great hunter and rider. She's described as having the courage of a man. And she did indeed ride with her troops on many occasions and walk with them. Now, her rise to power is nothing unusual. Zenobia was King Septimus Odenathus, king of Palmyra's second wife. They were married in 258 A.D. In 268 A.D., she gave birth to a son, Volbothus, whose name means gift of the goddess. His full name, Lucius Ulius Aurelius Septimus Volbothus Athenodorus. You're going to have a really big coin to put his name on when he becomes king. Well, the problem with this is, of course, Zenobia was the king's second wife. Well, there are two heirs to the throne. There is Heron, who is the king's son by his first wife, and now we have Volbothus, who is the king's son by Zenobia. And, of course, you figure this is going to eventually lead to trouble. Well, we get a little break here. The succession problem was solved in 267 A.D. when the king and his son, his first son, were assassinated by a nephew named Meonius. And there is some obvious discussion here as to, you know, who is responsible for this. It looks kind of fishy just a year after Zenobia gives birth to a son that this takes place, which, of course, allows her to become the regent. While they wait for him to come of age. But there really isn't any hard evidence at this particular time. So Volbothus, as I said, is 1 year old. So Zenobia rules Palmyra for him until he's old enough. Now, part of the reason that we have this taking place is, as Rome has always really kind of liked Palmyra, and because of what's going on. Now, the part about what is Rome really like about Palmyra. They've had good relations for a couple of reasons. One is lots of tax money. That money off of those caravan routes is filling the coffers of the empire. The other thing, it's strategic location, which is right there next to Rome's what they consider the most dangerous enemy off to the east. And the other part of it may actually come from Zenobia's dead husband's family. King Odenathus was also referred to as Odenat, and he had a grandfather or great-grandfather who had been a Roman senator in 230 A.D. Now you say, well, wait a minute, how does a Palmyran become a senator of Rome? You have to remember that in 212 AD, that was the year that Rome declared that all free men within the empire were citizens. And there are also some of these titles that are handed out, which have somewhat different meanings at this time in the empire than it did in the early days. So you have to kind of be careful, but it certainly does signify he was extremely important. Now, her husband had also been a Roman consul in AD 258 and assisted the Romans against the Senescids, especially after Emperor Valerian's defeat, capture, and death by them in 1260. Although there's some discussion that the Palmyrans were kind of edging towards the Senescids, but they didn't return to favor, so they were forced to stay in Rome. Now, the other thing that is going on is, you know, to some extent, Rome is happy that there's a boy on the throne and a young woman on the throne of Palmyra, because that didn't appear to be threatening, because Rome has enough threats. If you go back to 265 AD and you look at the map of the Roman Empire, they have lost Spain and Gaul for the most part, because it's now under the control of the Goths. I know a lot of people say, well, it's the Empire of the Gauls. Well, it's the Goths that come in and invaded and took over that region. Then they're going to lose Palmyra, which will include Egypt, Armenia, and other areas. There is the area in the Balkans, north of Greece, which for the most part is a shadily controlled area at best, where you have barbarian incursions. So Rome really only controls Greece, Italy, Sicily, and North Africa. So it's in a very, very weak position. Now, fortunately, after the death of Gallienus, the empire, which at that time reaches its absolute lowest point, is going to be revived. You're going to have Claudius Gothicus and Aurelian, and they will restore the empire. So we're going to have a little conquest action, but the empire nearly collapses at this particular point, which would have been interesting because it would have been probably a total collapse, because Palmyra would have survived, which is the core of what would have been the Eastern Empire, the Byzantine Empire. Constantinople had not been constructed yet. It was still just the town of Byzantium. So that could have really made a significant difference, but obviously it doesn't take place. So with Rome occupied by the Goths, Zenobia decides she's going to create a kingdom. By 269, Egypt had fallen to Zenobia, thanks to her able general Zabatus, and she even proclaimed herself Queen of Egypt. Now, the Egyptians aren't exactly wild about her. They revolted on her once, forcing her to subdue them a second time. Zenobia then led her forces to victory through Syria, Palestine, Lebanon. She took over the Asia Minor region of the empire, at least from Ankara in the north to Chalcedon down on the coast. So it's about two-thirds of what is now Turkey. But you still have the Roman Empire, Emperor Aurelian, dealing with the Goths. However, in 272, the emperor, after successfully dealing with the Goths, now turns his campaign to recover and reunite the empire. And Roman forces land in Syria in 272 and defeat Zenobia at Antioch. Zenobia and her son escape for a time, and then they are eventually captured by Roman cavalry on the Euphrates River. The city of Palmyra is destroyed and sacked, and the Palmyran Empire ends in 273 AD. Now, there's always a little discussion about what happens to Zenobia. There are some people who claim that she was killed or died on the way, because her son dies on the way. Balthus dies on the trip to Rome. But there's good evidence that she survived, because there's a great triumph that is held in Rome in 274 AD. Zenobia supposedly walked in front of her chariot, shackled with gold chains, appearing in Aurelian's triumph. But she wasn't executed. Aurelian admired her courage and dignity, as well as her beauty. And so the emperor gave her a villa, and it was located in what is now Tivoli, Italy. And then the story goes that Zenobia then married a senator who at one time had been a Roman governor, and they had two daughters, and their two daughters then intermarried with Roman families. And so the blood of Zenobia then traipses its way through various places within the empire. But she's a very fascinating lady. Antonia Fraser, in her book The Warrior Queens, likes to compare her to the warrior queen of Britain. And there's some interesting parallels, but an exceedingly intellectual lady. Stories go that in her later life as a matron of Rome, she would talk with people and invite people over, and they were always fascinated by sound of her voice because she spoke all these different languages, and so her Latin comes off with quite an accent. So as far as sources for this, The Warrior Queens by Fraser, Historia Augustus by Zosimus, The Cambridge Ancient History, Women as a Force in History by Abbott. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and leave a comment, ask a question, and check out the CDs. Thank you very much.